Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to Book Talk for Book Talk, a podcast where we deep dive into the writing of your favorite novels.
This season, we're exploring Sarah J. Maas's first installment in the Crescent City series. This is Jack.
And I'm Amy. This is part two of this week's episode.
The views expressed by the hosts are entirely their own and in no way represent the thoughts or intentions of the original author.
This podcast is a discussion, shared to spark thought and conversation on the characters and themes of this novel.
The interpretations presented in this podcast are just a few of the many possibilities. Listeners are encouraged to read along and share their own analysis of the text.
Though the hosts speak mostly within the constraints of this book, series and extended universe spoilers may be discussed with or without warning.
Explicit language, as well as themes of sex, violence, abuse, depression, self-harm, and death will recur throughout this podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
We then move into chapter 35, where Bryce and Hunt enter the secret basement of the Comitium, which houses cells and interrogation rooms, where Bryce assumes, quote, "the law stopped applying once one crossed over the threshold." Everything in this space is foreign to Bryce, and it makes her super uncomfortable. Everything smells like bleach. What is bleach used for? Cleaning up blood. There are drains every few feet. We can infer Bryce is thinking to wash away blood, pour it down the drain. And the first light above her drones like hornets. Like, nothing feels good about this place. Hunt, on the other hand, does not seem perturbed by it, and in fact comes across as a force of nature. Quote, "Hunt was a storm of black and gray against the shining white tiles. Bryce simply watched Hunt move, the way he cut through the world."
I love that line because we're seeing Bryce get strength from Hunt, that mimicking, that, you know, he's cutting through the world and she's feeling really vulnerable at this moment.
Yeah.
And she's seeing him. And I think that we're starting to get that little bit of like, I'm going to channel them.
I love it because I feel like we saw the same thing from Hunt's perspective regarding Bryce when they went to the Comitium the first time, where he was like, wait, she doesn't actually know where she's going. Why is she leading?
Right.
But she leads with such confidence.
Yep.
And I think that they appreciate that in each other.
Yes.
That they're able to be that confident figure and they're able to draw power from each other.
Mm-hmm.
In this moment, Bryce starts thinking about the source of first light. And Bryce even assumes that, quote, "with Hunt, the explosion of energy-filled light that had probably erupted from him when he'd made the drop had likely gone toward fueling an entire city." Hunt is feeling larger than life, and not in a way that scares Bryce. I think it intrigues her.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to point that out.
She's like, ooh.
Ooh.
You.
You could power an entire city. You could power my vibrator for a really long time.
I wasn't even going there. Finally, you're the one who goes there. After 300 pages of hearing about Briggs, we finally get to see him. Quote, "Bryce beheld the state of his gaunt, hollow face, willed herself not to flinch. His dark hair buzzed close to the scalp, and though not a bruise or scratch marred his skin, his deep blue eyes, empty and hopeless." So there's power to cutting hair. There's a lot of power to hair. Mm-hmm. And we see that in imagery throughout stories from the beginning of stories. I don't know about the beginning of stories, but like we've seen it throughout history. Right. One of which is like one of the most famous ones is Samson and Delilah, and she cuts his hair. But I think one of the most known stories is the story I'm going to tell you now. When I was in high school, there was a friend that I had. He had this like really nice, pretty, long, curly hair. He was pretty hot. And he threw a party at his house and his parents found out, and it was because they were gone for the weekend. He got in so much trouble, and his dad like sat him down and buzzed his hair and said, "You're no longer in trouble once it grows out."
Wow.
I know.
Did he become less hot with the short hair?
No, he was still so hot.
Unlike Harry Styles, who's definitely less attractive without the hair.
Yeah. It was, oh no, he was still a smoking, but like, it's just such a dehumanizing thing to like for that forced haircut, right? Like, I don't want to be like anyone who has buzzed hair, but it's that forced shedding of self and identity.
Yeah. Imagine if your mom sat you down and was like, I'm going to give you a pixie cut now.
No, no, we're not even going to begin to imagine it. My face's structure cannot handle that.
We know leading up to the scene that Bryce is an extremely empathetic person. She freed Syrinx from slavery. She tried to save Juniper from being hurt during the bombing of the White Raven. And Bryce always tries to help those less fortunate than her. So it makes sense she's horrified by the way Briggs looks that Jack just talked about. Even Hunt, from his point of view, has sympathy for Briggs. Quote, Hunt stared at the gaunt, haunted man, a shell of the powerfully built adult he'd seen 2 years ago. What they were doing to him in that prison, Hunt could take a few guesses about the manner of torture. The memories of it being inflicted upon him still dragged him from sleep. And I think that's important in this scene, because I don't think Hunt nor Bryce were prepared to feel empathy for Briggs when they were mentally preparing to go meet him.
Yeah, neither were expecting that. But again, it shows how good of characters they are. You know, they're good people. It also, to me, shows how stupid Briggs is. Like, you have two people who are empathetic to your cause, like to your situation, and he kind of makes them both feel like crap. Like, he goes for the jugular for both. For Bryce, Briggs, the way that he's insulting her is to essentially insult women and her mother. But he also hits the nail on the head, which makes it annoying.
Yeah.
Quote, when you see your mother, it's a human mother for you, isn't it? It always is. And again, like, because he's talking about the discrimination against humans, especially humans that are left abandoned and alone are typically women. And it makes sense. But it's also like, bro, you don't have to be this hard about it and this mean.
Yeah, he really cuts off the empathy supply that Bryce is willing to give him. Because he even calls her undesirable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people like you, because you're basically because you're a half-breed.
Yeah.
And he could have played a different game. I also want to take a moment to make this personal and about race. Because this is a euphemism for race, essentially, right? The Vanir versus the humans is very much basically white versus other.
Yeah.
And when Briggs says this, it makes me think of my own experience with my parents being mixed race, because everyone assumes my mother is the Asian one.
Interesting.
Because it's usually a white man marrying an Asian woman, which is not the case. And I got that both in America and in China.
Wow.
In China, everyone assumed my father was the chauffeur.
Yeah.
Not my father. I love the way that SJM is doing this, because it does really speak to human experience in our own society.
Yeah. And in my case, my mother is the Hispanic one.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, most people, even though my last name is Asian, they assume I married an Asian. They don't assume my father is Asian.
Really?
Yeah, most people.
You also don't do your makeup in a way that makes you look more Asian. So I guess people get confused.
I don't know.
I don't know either. I just, like, when I look at you, I just associate, grew up in China.
Right, if you know me.
If you know me.
All I say is, well, I grew up in China.
That was all of last episode of me editing. Of like, was it? You're like, I grew up in China. I was like, fuck.
To top it all off, not only does Briggs alienate Bryce, he then drops the bomb that Danica went easy on him. And I don't know why he thinks that was going to win him points.
I know.
But this is what he says, quote, for a Vanir, she was fair. I don't think she necessarily disagreed with us. With my methods, yes, but I thought she might have been a sympathizer. I think she even let some of my followers get away that night. I think what even sets it off more is that it was more important for Briggs to let the cause live on and get captured if it meant that he could protect Danica mm-hmm. as a potential ally for the cause.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really disturbing for Bryce. I think that this scene is a pretty big turning point in our understanding for who Danica is, and it's going to become a turning point for Bryce's understanding of Danica. But beyond that, it's also a turning point, in my mind, for Hunt and his own self-perception. He finally starts to question his past, quote, "Had he been this out of touch with reality when he'd followed Shahar? He'd been so wildly in love with Shahar, with the cause, had he been no better than this man? Up until this point, all of Hunt's actions have been a means to an end. But when we consider that he just assassinated someone last night, and he's still feeling raw about it, Hunt is not prepared to guard himself mentally from anything Briggs might say. I think if Hunt had not assassinated someone the night before, he mm-hmm. just would have been like, this man's crazy.
Yeah.
Briggs even calls Hunt brother by saying, you know, bring the bastards down someday. And Hunt realizes in this moment just how similar he is to Briggs. And he thinks, quote, Hunt had been no better than this man. He didn't know where that put him. And I think this is when we are going to see Hunt really begin to open himself up to the possibility that he doesn't have to accept reality as it is. Because that's all he's been doing for the past 233 years.
Yeah.
Of like, well, this is my reality.
Mm-hmm.
This is how I perceive reality. Therefore, I have to go do this thing. And he's allowed his agency to be dictated by other people mm-hmm. in power. Shahar.
Yeah.
And all the archangels who've owned him. Because he's starting to be like, well, I don't want to be this person. I don't have to be this person. That's when he's really going to start opening up to Bryce.
Yeah. I mean, he's got to wallow a little bit first.
Yeah.
Brood. Stare at the stars.
Because he's, you know, tall, dark, and handsome mm-hmm. and broody.
Mm-hmm. When Bryce and Hunt get home, Hunt, like I said, is a broody, broody male. And Bryce is in a different kind of mood. Like, I love that. Hunt's like sitting there, be like, I'm in my own head. I'm really upset. Meanwhile, Hunt, quote, wore a soft gray t-shirt, black sweats, and white sunball cap turned backward. It was the hat that had proven the most confusing part. So ordinary and guyish. She had no idea, but it was all just disgustingly distracting. Like, he's like in his feels, and she's like, it's kind of hot. And, you know, by far, this is one of the top five sluttiest outfits men could wear.
Mm-hmm.
My personal opinion, it should be gray sweatpants and a black top, you know, just to add it up. But, mm-hmm. you know, that's fine. But again, this is showing that Bryce is attracted to the masculine and not the alpha hole.
Mm-hmm.
She'll eventually fall for alpha hole-ish, alpha hole adjacent, because it's going to be Hunt's version of alpha hole.
Well, yeah, and I think, like I said earlier, Hunt's alpha hole is a facade.
Yeah.
And Bryce can finally see that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why she's able to fall for it.
Yeah.
Just like Hunt is going to be real turned on by her vapidness later.
Yeah.
I also just want to point out that Hunt's clothing is a gradient. He has black pants, a gray top, and a white cap.
Oh, that's such a good one.
His brain chemistry is literally changing right now after seeing Briggs. And that change is conveyed to us in black and white through his clothing.
I love that so much. And then, like, there's that term wearing the white hat.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you're the good guy, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Good job.
I also want to point out that I think this is the first time we see the white baseball cap.
Mm-hmm.
And it only makes an appearance after Hunt has realized his own folly.
Yeah.
And he's had it for years,
mm-hmm.
but we as readers only see it once Hunt has realized, like, wow, I need to change. Wow, there's something wrong with me.
I used to have this rule on dating apps that if I saw a guy with a backwards baseball cap, it was an immediate no.
Mm. Yeah, different this opinion now?
I'm willing to change. I'm willing to look past it.
In this scene, we return to the use of photos on the cell phone. What I like about this is that the use of the cell phone and the taking pictures is not overdone. And in fact, when we get to later in the novel, we're going to see that a lot of it happens off page.
Mm-hmm.
We do see it in moments, but it's not, oh my gosh, every chapter they're taking photos, yeah. right? When we do see it being used, it's almost like a weapon between the two.
Yeah.
up until this point, in 350 pages in practically, they like to banter. They like to quip.
Mm-hmm.
They like the back and forth jabs. And now the cell phone gets to be a part of that. And the picture taking gets to be part of that.
Yeah.
And in my notes, I'm like, AKA flirting.
I mean, I've done that. Mm-hmm. Where it's like, if I like a guy and they feel like they're flirting, I will always steal their phone.
Yeah.
Take a photo of them. And then it's like, see me in hindsight, tangled up with you all night, burning it down. But it's totally like I've left my mark.
Yes. You know this picture of you is from me.
One day you're going to be like on your phone and your phone's going to be like, memories from this time. Would you like to look at it? And it's going to be me. We find out that Hunt was captive in a very similar prison to Briggs for 7 years. Magical number. There's, of course, they let him out after 7 years.
Of course.
Thank God that the Asteri aren't Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
It would have been 13 years.
Yeah. Miserable.
And Hunt opens up about seeing himself in Briggs. And he's being very vulnerable to Bryce at this moment because she was vulnerable to him about the Oracle and her dad. So now it's kind of like, oh, well, you know, you're able to do it. I guess I'll do it, too. And it's amazing how Hunt talks about not seeing the sun for so long. And he ends up with someone who's basically pure light. Right? Bryce reaches out to Hunt then, quite literally. She holds his hand. And then we all collectively squeal.
Yes.
Because she holds his hand.
Yes.
Bryce is bringing comfort to Hunt through physical contact, which is huge considering how Hunt talked about how isolated he was. Like, you know, not only did he not see the sun for 7 years, plus because he was like then moved and then tortured for several more years, I doubt he got nice contact, physical touch, right? And this is like so simple, just holding a hand. But where in Bryce's POV when this happens, quote, Hunt glanced down at their hands, her dusk-painted nails contrasting with the deep gold of his skin. I want to point out that I personally believe it's important that it's in Bryce's point of view is because these nails are from when she got them done earlier in the book when Hunt still thought she was a vapid party girl idiot. I can only imagine what's going through Hunt's mind when he looks down and sees their hands and sees her nails and is probably like, I am an idiot.
Yeah. Yeah. He's like, why did I judge her so hard for getting her nails done?
Yeah. Also, I keep going on Pinterest trying to figure out what dusk colored nails look like. Have yet to find anything.
I think it's kind of like an ombre.
Yeah. But like what? Like pink and blues?
Yeah. Because it's the same manicure she got when she went to the.
Yeah.
It is. It's a pink to blue ombre.
Pink to blue ombre. Thank you.
So I want to add to this, and I want to suggest that Hunt only earns physical affection from Bryce when he chooses to be vulnerable with her. I say that in such a negative way, but what it is it indicates a growing connection. And it's really reliant on Bryce's bleeding heart and her endless capacity for empathy. But that doesn't stop Hunt from wanting to punish himself. So when Bryce tells Hunt, you're not like Briggs, Hunt tries to physically withdraw because he can't accept that because to accept that would be to turn everything he believes about himself on his head right now.
Yeah.
And he wants to be in his spiral. So he tries to withdraw physically because he's no longer comfortable being vulnerable. But I love it that, quote, Bryce clamped her fingers around his. You might see yourself that way, but I see you too, Athalar. I see your kindness. I see the shit you conveniently forget. Bryce forces Hunt to keep holding on, forces him to focus on her, and tells him basically, you might want to punish yourself, but I'm here and I know that you don't need to. As a result, he becomes hesitant to let go after just trying to like force his hand back, which I think opens the door for them to test the boundaries of their physical proximity.
Oh yeah, because he's going to hold her finger later.
Yeah, well, and like their thighs are touching and they keep getting closer.
But in the next chapter, it's a finger.
It is a finger. I also want to note that when Bryce asks Hunt if he still feels like hatred is all that gets him through the day, he tells her no, quote, his eyes lifting from their hands to scan her face. Sometimes for some things, yes, but no, Quinlan. And that's because she gets him through the day.
Right. He tugs her braid.
I know, it's so cute.
I like when I read that, I was like, if Damn it, that's adorable. It is more adorable. Men gently tugged braids.
It is adorable. And just like earlier in this episode, Bryce is now seeing a change in Hunt's eyes, mm-hmm. in that her description of them is different. She realizes they're not actually black, but a deep brown. He's not actually the Umbra Mortis. He actually has human features.
He is just the Umbra.
Anyway, it indicates a change in her perspective about him. Moving on, I want everyone to know that chapter 36 is probably my most favorite chapter in this entire novel.
Yeah.
It's just so good. I love it for the humor and I love it for the personal interactions.
Mm-hmm.
If we remember back to the bombing at the White Raven, Hunt was very attentive to Bryce's damaged ears. And we know from Rune's perspective earlier in the novel that Fae ears are very sensitive, meaning Bryce's ears are very sensitive. Jack, I want you to look me dead in the eyes.
All right, I'm looking.
And tell me that this isn't the fucking cutest thing on the planet.
No, I won't, because it's the fucking cutest thing on the planet.
Quote, before he entered the gallery, Hunt glanced over his shoulder at Bryce, checking that her earmuffs were in place. She noticed his assessing look and chuckled. Mother hen. I wouldn't want your pretty little ears to get blown out, Quinlan.
He only wants her back blown out.
I did think that too.
Not only is this so stinking cute, but we're also seeing Bryce's sentiments change.
Mm-hmm.
He's being protective, but she's not viewing it as being an alpha hole.
That's right.
She's viewing it as being a mother hen.
Yeah, which is cute. It's which so is cute. Also very feminine.
Yep, exactly.
When they get into the shooting range, Hunt sees Rune, Declan, and Flynn playing around with their guns and, quote, he didn't expect the tinge of envy curdling in his gut at the sight of the friends together. Remember, earlier in the novel, we learned Hunt doesn't have friends, doesn't make friends, doesn't know how to make friends. So now that he's starting to open up, now that he's starting to humanize himself again, he's capable of acknowledging that he's actually jealous, mm-hmm. and he does want to have friends, which will influence his actions later.
Agreed. And, you know, I kind of go back to, like, this question of, like, did Hunt ever have friends? Uh-huh. You know, and when Hunt looks at the Fae Bros all together, he sees the friends and he imagines Bryce with, you know, the pack of devils, mm-hmm. and everything. And again, like, did Hunt have friends? I'm not convinced with that. But for Hunt, the pack was Shahar,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, the military group at that time. Like, Isaiah was probably the closest one, but again, he was in charge of Isaiah. He was the leader. And I think the jealousy kind of comes from his desire for Bryce,
mm-hmm.
because Bryce is also the closest thing he has to a friend.
Yeah.
And unlike all the other SJM characters, they really focus on building a friendship.
Yeah.
Hence the first several hearts of book two.
Right.
And, you know, that's a really important thing for Bryce. And, you know, I think what he looks longingly is the camaraderie that he had with Shahar.
Yeah.
But he didn't have a friendship with her.
Right. There was too much of a power difference between them for there to be a friendship.
Mm-hmm. There's something that he said at one point in the section. I can't remember where it is, but he's like, I went from this to that to then being her lover.
Yeah, there was never friends.
There is never relationship.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, he was in love with her, but was she ever in love with him?
Oh, absolutely not.
Okay, well, I'm happy we came to that conclusion.
I mean, I don't think so.
I agree.
I think we learned this maybe in Sky and Breath. She never, I don't think, said I love you.
I can't remember. But you know what? I believe it.
As you mentioned, Jack, what drives the point home to me that Hunt wants the companionship and friendship of Bryce is the fact that he gets that jealous feeling when Bryce and Flynn flirt.
Mm-hmm.
And later he's going to ask if they ever hooked up.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning he's wondering if he needs to take Flynn out.
Mm-hmm.
What is so great about this chapter is Bryce demonstrates her power by beating Rune and his friends at their own pissing contest. And how Hunt reacts is just perfect. There are parts where I literally underline in my book that it's so frank SJM.
She's not even trying.
No.
She's basically just sitting here and be like, hey, y'all, guns, sex. Like, this yeah. is a sex scene.
This is sex.
This is, like, as close to having sex in front of Rune that Bryce will get.
It's true.
When Rune challenges Bryce, she says, quote, I don't need to prove I can handle a big gun to run with the boys club. Hunt's skin tightened at the feral delight in her eyes as she said, big gun. I'm just going to be reading several quotes because, like, again, this is so good. Pure sex at this point. Then Bryce, when she winks at Hunt, quote, his blood thrummed, his body tensing, as surely as if she gripped his cock.
Wow. So frank, SJM.
Like, the girl just winked at him. Oh my God. And then the act of shooting itself, quote, three shots cracked over the music, one after another, her body absorbing the kickback of the gun like a champ. Hunt's mouth dried out internally.
It's so much sex. I mean, like, it's any romance novel probably says he bought him out in her and she took it like a champ.
Yeah, you know what I mean? And yeah. Like, that's exactly what's happening where, like, she's taking it like a champ, like the way he's gonna fuck her.
Yeah. I'm
blushing. It's just like, oh my God. Bryce shoots the gun, right? Mm-hmm. And three shots in a row, you know, almost like a perfect hole, just slight variations in there, but it's all within the same hole. And Bryce worries that Hunt's going to be threatened by that, that he's going to be an alpha hole. But, you know, Hunt shows that he's not. So he shoots through her holes. He penetrates her holes
with his gun with and his bullet.
Big gun that she can handle. Like, SJM had so much fun writing this. Oh, yes,
she sure did.
You know, what we're seeing in this section also is that sex and violence are intertwining. We saw that with Feyre and Rhys when we did our analysis in ACOTAR. I don't think it's as intense as it was there. Mm-hmm. This is a very contained way of showing violence, but it's a common theme in books and in movies. So, you know, keep an eye out for that for what's to come.
Yeah, I had like sex and death written all over my book at this point.
Sex and death.
What I think I'm seeing in this whole interaction is Bryce's reciprocity to Hunt's vulnerability from the night before. The night before, Hunt is on the couch unloading his past trauma. And now Bryce is unloading in her own way. Quote, a new sort of vulnerability shown beneath the self-satisfied narrowing, a challenge thrown down, waiting to see how he'd react. Where Bryce reacted with physical intimacy, aka hand-holding, when Hunt was vulnerable, Hunt now reacts by matching Bryce's energy and symbolic intimacy with the penetration of the hole. And that's exactly what they both needed in this moment.
To be penetrated in the hole. Yep. We're so mature.
I also want to give a shout out to Anne, who pointed out the significance of this moment, which we talk about in our Listener Theories episode from January 2nd.
So go check that out if you want to hear it. Because it's shout out, extra shout out to Anne. When we didn't record this in our interview with Lily and Rosie, who are SJM theorists experts. When we read Anne's theory to Lily and Rosie, they were both freaking out.
Yeah, they nearly had a meltdown too. Yeah. So we did put it in the breadcrumbs just for everybody else.
Oh, I was like ready to force them to go and listen.
Oh yeah, just go back and listen to the January 2nd episode.
Yep.
Chapter 36 ends with a phone call from Isaiah that there's been another murder by the Crystallos demon. Chapter 37 starts up with them identifying the location. And I think we're going to see in this first part of this scene, Hunt's continued changing awareness. First off, he's willing to admit that Rune, Declan, and Flynn are really well trained. Mm-hmm. He hates admitting that because we know Angels and Fae have a rivalry. We see it in the painting in Rune's house. Mm-hmm. But he's like, damn, they are good.
Yeah.
In addition to that, he's able to finally pick up on Bryce's tells when she isn't okay. He sees her fidget and he can tell that she's being fake calm.
Bryce set the pace and Hunt is following. Just like how when she reached out her hand when Hunt was struggling, Hunt is now holding her hand. First, it's a finger and he lets go, quote, remembering her wariness of male veneer. Or alpha holes. So he heard what Bryce had said earlier, but similar to when Hunt tried to let go, Bryce doubled down. Hunt does let go, but then he comes back and doubles down. Quote, it was instinct to take her hand in his own. They trembled like glasses rattling on a shelf. And remember when I talked about Hunt being compared to a trembling live wire? I feel some parallels here that, you know, Hunt was a trembling live wire and Bryce is rattling glass. And both of these descriptions are of the other, mm-hmm. describing them. That means Bryce viewed Hunt as something dangerous. Hunt is viewing Bryce as something fragile.
Yeah.
I personally feel like that's going to shift throughout. Like, he's starting to see her more, that's for sure. But I don't think he sees fully her resilience just yet because of that description. Before Amy talks about Bryce and Hunt parallels, there's one thing I want to point out. Earlier in this episode, when Hunt went to the Oracle and smelled sulfur and meat and everything that just smelled like crap there, mm-hmm. I feel like that's a parallel to Bryce at this moment as she's walking down the alley and, quote, the cloying reek of trash stuffing itself up her nose. Bryce tried not to inhale too much. And these are both smelly places where they learn the truth.
Yeah.
About things.
Yeah.
About the horn.
About the horn. SJM is very intentional about her use of smell.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we bring it up, why Lily brings it up, why Rosie brings it mm-hmm. up. Like, everybody brings it up. The parallels between Bryce and Hunt in this scene, I don't think are lost on either of them. And I think that's why they are beginning to feel safe with one another. We learn Bryce has never let anyone see her admit to her own panic attacks. But because, quote, she'd seen Hunt come in from his mission the other night and was not all right, she knew he, of all people, might get it. So she's like, wow, he wasn't okay. So I think that means I can be not okay.
Not okay, yeah. Huge difference than the first time.
Right, exactly.
She saw a scene, yeah.
Bryce also thinks to herself that, quote, they were two of a kind. Like, she could throw anything at him and he'd catch it, would meet every challenge with that wicked feral grin. But they both called each other
mm-hmm.
out for having feral grins.
Yeah.
And it's adorable because they are so aligned.
Yep.
They are so similar. And I think it's significant that right after both of them have seemed to struggle with jealousy when seeing Rune and his friends dick around together, that Hunt confirms for Bryce that they are an us. That he can look at the crime scene for us, quote, us, like they were a unit against the fucking mess of a world. And I love that they, in their need, are finally like, yeah, you know what? We could be friends. I like the idea of you and I being mm-hmm. companions. And, you know, too bad Hunt's going to fuck it up.
Yeah, Hunt's going to fuck it up. And I feel like in this book and in the next book, there's a journey of them figuring out that us.
Yeah.
They both desire the us. It just kind of backfires a few times. Not backfires. Neither are kind of willing to go there all the way.
Yeah.
But they still want it.
Right. I think us is complicated in any relationship. It takes yeah. time to really figure out all the nuances and the boundaries.
And respecting of the times where you're not an us and right. they're their own person.
Exactly. I also think in this chapter, we see just how badly Bryce wants to reconnect with Rune. Like Hunt, Bryce is opening herself up again, even if she's reluctant about it. After Bryce sees the connection between the murder scenes and the ley lines of power, quote, her brother merely gave her an impressed nod before going over to the Ox team. She ignored what that admiration did to her. To me, this is emphasized by the fact that later in the chapter, we learn that Bryce did not want to go home with Flynn when they ran into each other at a bar in college, quote, because Bryce hadn't wanted to mess up anything between him and Rune. Like, she's so sensitive mm-hmm. to Rune.
She does care about him.
She cares.
Yeah.
She just doesn't want to admit it.
Yeah.
Because he hurt her.
He hurt her, but she'll be listening to Hosab. I was like, they love each other.
They really do love each other. I can't wait until we get to Sky and
Breath. CC3, yeah. Okay, so let me get into a little bit more of this moment, right, of Bryce deciding not to go home with Flynn. Bryce had a crush on Flynn for 2 years, right? She journaled Lady Bryce Flynn.
I feel like for more than that. Right?
Probably for more. She said something about 2 years.
Okay.
She had a huge thing for him. And she's not afraid of admitting it either.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, she told Hunt straight up. She even laughs about the idea that she journals it.
Yeah.
So there's no way that you can tell me that she didn't tell Danica.
Of course.
All of this. And I'm going to reread that quote. going back to why Bryce didn't sleep with Flynn, quote, how Danica had gone home with Flynn because Bryce hadn't wanted to mess anything between him and Rune. Danica goes home with her crush. This right here is when you've lost me.
Yeah.
I am not a Danica fan for this reason.
Yeah.
There is no world where you're with your best friend and you see your old crush come in and be like, oh my God, I was like in love with this guy. She could have easily just not slept with him. But even in this moment, Bryce is kind of defending Danica.
Yeah.
As if like she did me a favor by going home with him because yeah. I didn't want to. You both could have left the bar.
Right.
You both could have gone home with other guys.
Right.
But Danica decided to go back, decided to sleep with her crush. Fuck you.
Yeah.
I am so mad at that. And let's go back to Lahaba saying that Danica was mean and not a good friend. You can't convince me that Danica was a good friend. I don't care. Light it up, Bryce. Light it up. Light it up. You deserve to be dead. Like, I just like, what? Oh. I don't mean that. I don't mean that on even any fictional character, but it's just like the rage that I'm feeling of like the code.
Yeah.
The friend code is broken.
Yes. Friend code is definitely broken. I think that both Danica and Bryce have struggled to receive affection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bryce was sincerely and utterly loved by her mother and Randall, but she never got the love she wanted from her father.
Yeah.
Or from Rune.
Yeah.
Danica never got any love from her mother. And so they have a lot of trauma from that and yeah. are willing. And so I think that they do sincerely love each other, but they're willing to do shitty things to each other because they know no better.
They know no better. And it's so easy not to do shit to each other. That's the other thing. Is like.
But they're willing to accept love crumbs.
What shit does Bryce give Danica beyond this type of betrayal? The most she told her was your skinny ass, right. Your bony ass.
Yeah. What it's telling me is Danica is really, really selfish. And we see that in all the lies that she kept. She's just so selfish.
Unbelievably selfish. Doesn't really care for Bryce, no matter how you... She cares for Bryce in her own way. Y'all, whatever. But this
but not
is...
not in a healthy way.
Not in a healthy way. That's beyond her. So, I have issues with Danica, if you haven't been able to tell. Also, she's described it as her freshman year of college. Do you mind looking that up?
Yeah.
Because I want to prove a point. It's 362.
Senior year.
Okay, fine.
Which, no, proves your point. They've known each other for 4 years by this point.
They've known each other for 4 years, but also that wasn't that much time between her crush and then.
Yeah.
So.
And let's be real. Women don't get over their crushes that quickly.
Never.
You Blake, always hold out a little bit of a flame for them.
Blake from kindergarten. I refuse to say his last name because, like,
yeah,
that's not the way that I want him to find out. Moving on to other happy things, like Hunt's inability to love again.
Yeah. That's real happy.
After reassuring Hunt that she didn't sleep with Flynn, after telling him about the worst sex invitation that she ever received, she then asks him what we all want to know. Does he still have a thing for Shahar? And it's an exchange of information, but it's an unequal exchange.
Yeah.
It's, you know, a crush and then bad sex. Like, she's kind of being like, hey, here are these light things. Tell me about your stuff. She's not talking about Connor.
Right.
And I feel like it's kind of an unfair way of getting information. And I don't want to say unfair to Hunt. It's more unfair to Bryce herself because you're giving these light, airy stories.
And then asking for something real deep.
Yeah. And there's nuance to the deepness. Mm-hmm. You know, had she compared it or talked about Connor where it's like nothing happened, but we were going to and everyone assumed and he thinks that I was his mate. Like, you know, like there's a lot of stuff to that.
Yeah.
Then I think she'd be on the right level with Hunt once he answers her of like, does he still love her? And he says, quote, until the day I die, I don't see how I can move on from loving her when she gave up everything for me, for the cause. Every time I hook up, I remember it. And which kind of goes back to what that one time we were like, was he celibate? We're like, oh, wait, no, I forgot. He fucks. Again, it's just, it's a little different than what she went through with Connor, but it's not the same as these two stories. For Hunt, love and loyalty are blurred. Mm-hmm. And I would even argue for Bryce and Connor. Mm-hmm. Did she really love Connor or care about him? Or was she just super loyal to him in the pack of devils? Love and loyalty can be blinding. You need both for a relationship, but I think loyalty can confuse, you can confuse it for love. Or loyalty overtakes love, and then you're not staying for the right reasons.
Right, right.
And I think that's Hunt right there.
And I think, unfortunately for Hunt, his definition of love is shallow.
Yeah.
I don't think he actually truly knows what love is at this point. And so he substitutes love with loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's as far as his understanding goes.
The only one who's loved him, really.
Is his mom.
Yeah. And she died when he was younger.
Yep.
So.
Messed up.
It's messed up. He's a sweet baby boy. So different to other seasons when we would cut down.
Yeah.
Farrah and Reese. Yeah. Like, yeah, we destroyed them. And we're like, our sweet baby angels, Bryce and Hunt, they can do no wrong. They're just broken.
They are very broken, though.
Yeah. Sabine shows up, and this is such a, like, you know, Hunt's about to say, like, that's not to say, Quinlan, or Quinlan, that's not to say, and he gets cut off when they see Sabine, and it's such a movie move.
Yeah, such a movie move. Because it's like,
what were you going to say, Hunt?
Unks, unks, unks.
Unks? It is the unks?
I said it with a British accent.
Is that what that is? Because I don't think the British say it that way either.
I think so either.
Hey, if you're a listener from any other part of the world, can you just send us a video note of you saying unks so that Amy has variations?
I'm sure someone says it unks.
Unks? Do we have any German listeners? You know, they're like, Sabine is there and, quote, stupid slut, Sabine hissed, spitting at Bryce's feet as she passed. Like, whoa, rude, rude. I feel like we're on episode 7 and this is like, now I'm finally having a slight thing to say about the writing in this book, which is impressive, considering that we've been a little more critical in other seasons. Even then, we're still super nice, but I feel like it was a little heavy-handed to bring in Sabine for this 1 second to then 3 pages later say, Sabine was the one who had access to the cameras. And my hunch is that that was a slight scene that happened earlier somewhere that SJM couldn't fit in. Because it's just such a, like, why is Sabine there other than to ruin the moment and then to remember that she's a character that is, quote-unquote, potentially evil. It just was too close.
I can see what you're saying. I have a different opinion. My opinion has always been Sabine shows up as a red herring. That, of course, Sabine would show up at every crime scene where she was involved to make sure that she doesn't look like a suspect.
Yeah, she could have been there. She could have been leaving as they showed up. I mean, was that what it was? She was going to the crime scene?
Yeah.
I didn't even put that together.
Yeah, they're still at the crime scene.
They're leaving it, yeah.
Yeah. She's going to the crime scene. I don't know if it's, like, in her jurisdiction for that day or whatever the case is, but I just assumed she's there at the crime scene so that when we get the news that she altered the video footage about Luna's horn, we're like, ah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
She keeps showing up at inopportune times.
That's fair. If I was her editor, I would suggest moving that to the front of the crime scene. It's just the 3 pages later thing that kind of bugged me.
That's fair.
Let's get into some breadcrumbs. These are safe, non-multiverse breadcrumbs.
But they still reveal stuff from Sky and Breath. So spoilers.
Yeah. We've done what we can. In chapter 31, quote, in Pangaea, the cities were little more than pens for the Vanir to trap and feed on the humans and their children. No wonder the humans had risen up. Readers will get to see that in Sky and Breath, and Hunt and Bryce will deal with those children themselves.
Yep. In chapter 32, Bryce tells Hunt she assumes he curses the stars, broods, and plotted the revenge of all his enemies at night. Hunt thinks she didn't know the half of it because he's getting the synth.
I wrote that.
Good job.
Thank you.
I did underline it in my book as like a breadcrumb, and I was like, why is this a breadcrumb?
Right. In chapter 33, the Oracle calls Hunt, quote, Lord of Lightning, and addresses him by his full name, Orion Athalar. Feel it in my bones. We're going to find out he is descended of Thur, whose history is a topic of discussion in Sky and Breath. Also, Thur is Thor, thunder god. Like, that connection is there.
Yeah. Also, in chapter 33, the Oracle says to Hunt before he leaves, quote, "You remind me of that which was lost long ago. I had not realized it might ever happen again. And I feel it in my bones that whatever this means will come up in flame and shadow."
In chapter 34, Hunt tells Bryce, quote, "There are some Vanir pledged to their, Ophion's, cause. Like Cormac."
Like Cormac. Still in chapter 34, Bryce says that the, quote, "horn can only be used by Starborn Fae. By you, Rune." Oops. Did she almost reveal that there might be more than one Starborn Fae?
Mm-hmm. Still in chapter 34, Rune responds by saying, "I'm not sure I could use the horn. Prince Pelias possessed what was basically an ocean of starlight in his disposal. Like Bryce, which is why Bryce is the one who uses the horn."
Last in chapter 34, when Hunt questions why the Oracle would tell him about the vision she saw for Bryce, Bryce explains that, quote, "the visit with the Oracle provides a glimpse toward what sort of power they might ascend to when mature. When the Oracle looked into her smoke during Bryce's visit, she screamed and clawed at her eyes. I heard later that she went blind for a week. That's because the Oracle was blinded by starlight."
And probably deserved it.
Yep.
In chapter 35, quote, "What would Bryce's own first light go towards? What small mote that it would be?" Much more than a mote, Bryce. It would heal the entire city.
Yay.
And Hunt.
And Hunt. In chapter 36, when Hunt picks up the rifle to replicate Bryce's shot at the gun range, he turns off the gun safety. Quote, "that click reverberated between them, loud as a thunderclap."
Again, if you want to hear us freaking out more about that, please go listen to the listener email episode. In chapter 37, the camera footage cannot find traces of the Crystallos demon around the crime scene. Quote, "it's like they knew where the cameras were, or whoever summoned it did. It stayed out of sight, because it's an inside job."
And last in chapter 37, Declan tells Bryce, quote, "the angels don't give a shit about anyone, B. Hunt's goals are not your goals. Athalar's goals might not even be the same as Micah's. Be careful." And finally, a breadcrumb for Hunt's betrayal.
Mm-hmm. Now we're going to be getting into some multiverse thoughts and breadcrumbs. In chapter 33, the horn is used to, quote, "open the doorway between worlds. The horn's purpose wasn't merely to close doors. It opens them, too. It depends on what the bearer wishes. Just like Bryce wishes at the end of Sky and Breath to find the Prince of Hell when she uses the horn to escape the Asteria and then ends up in Perthian."
Question mark, question mark, question mark.
Going into chapter 34, Rune tells Bryce and Hunt, quote, "I read some mentions of the horn having a sort of sentience to it, almost like it was alive. Like the Dread Trove in Prithian is perhaps part of the trove."
Also in chapter 34, Bryce and Hunt have a conversation about the lost library from Parthos. "Did you know that Parthos in our world is a settlement of the Illyrian tribe of the Partheni in southern Illyria, which is currently modern Albania? If Parthos in Midgard is supposedly an ancient human civilization that predates the Asteri, could it be that some fae like Illyrians already existed on Midgard, but not enough to sustain the Asteri?"
It's so rude. Maybe, it's just rude.
Maybe we'll find out in Flame and Shadow.
Like, it's just being this smart. Being this clever SJM is just rude.
It just hurts.
It's just, wow. In chapter 35, Briggs describes his torture. Quote, "they take me apart like a cadaver and then stitch me up again before nightfall. Their med witch is smoothing everything away, just like Aelin in Kingdom of Ash."
That one hurt.
Yep.
Still in chapter 35, Hunt's first archangel handler is named Ramuel. Any association with Mount Ramiel?
Yeah.
In the Night Court?
Yep. In chapter 35, Hunt talks about being in prison. Quote, "by the time Ramuel decided to let me serve as his assassin, it had been 9 years since I'd seen sunlight, since I heard the wind or smelled rain, since I'd seen grass or a river or a mountain, since I'd flown. Reminds me of Amarin escaping the prison and Rhys after the events under the mountain."
Just, you know, constantly have to have traumatized people.
Mm-hmm.
In chapter 37... while this isn't a multiverse breadcrumb, but it is a book two breadcrumb.
I should have put it in the top.
That's all right. Bryce thinks of her and Hunt, quote, like they were two of a kind, like she could throw anything at him and he'd catch it, would meet every challenge with that wicked feral grin because they are mates.
Mm-hmm. And finally, in chapter 37, the Daystar, Shahar, would have led the angels, maybe everyone, to a freer world, but she'd been extinguished, another dreamer crushed under the boot heel of the Asteri. There may be no connection, but this definitely makes me think of Court of Dreams, aka the Inner Circle.
Right?
Yep, yep. This week's Bryceism, vulnerability is sexy.
So sexy.
So do it first. Don't be afraid. Just be say afraid. It. What's the worst that can happen?
They'll say no.
Yeah. And you know what? You were vulnerable. They were the weak ones.
That's right. So, Jack, going back to the question we had at the start of the episode, is there a difference between love and loyalty for these characters?
I forgot I was the one who had to answer this when I wrote. Damn it. At this point, no. The only person who understands love is Bryce with her parents, because she was screwed over by Rune. She was screwed over by the Autumn King. Clearly her and Danica, there was some love, but it just was not healthy. I think that there was a lot of loyalty and love mixed up in their dynamic.
Yep.
I think that if Bryce understood loyalty, sometimes shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
Like sometimes you should be able to walk away despite the loyalty. Mm-hmm. She would have walked away.
Yeah.
And Hunt, we've already established, like, baby boy doesn't understand anything beyond the two. Right now, there isn't that difference between anyone.
Yeah.
But there's hope for Bryce, and that hope for Bryce means that she can teach Hunt.
So we didn't talk much about Rune in this chapter. I'm going to argue Rune is probably the only one who knows the difference between love and loyalty.
Oh my God, you're right. I take it back. Yes. Yes.
He loves Bryce, but he's loyal to his father.
Yep.
Yeah. He has no love for the Autumn King.
You're absolutely right. He's the only one who has like the clear distinction between the two.
And I think that's why Bryce struggles so much with Rune, because she can confuse love and loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
And so for Rune to be loyal to the Autumn King, in her mind, is equivalent to love.
Yeah.
Therefore, he doesn't love her because he's not demonstrating that same loyalty necessarily in her mind. I do agree with your point that Bryce is going to learn it first.
Yeah.
The difference between the two. And she is going to teach Hunt by example.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, Hunt is going to learn the hard way.
Yeah. I mean, his betrayal with the whole synth and everything is him being loyal to Shahar still.
Right. But being loyal to Shahar, being loyal to his kind.
Yeah. Yep. I think that's going to be a fun growth between the two.
Yeah.
And between love and loyalty. Be a good book name.
Yeah.
No one take it. Dibs. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Book Talk for Book Talk. We encourage you to rate and subscribe to our show on your preferred podcast listening platform. Next week, we'll be exploring chapters 38 through 43 of A House of Earth and Blood.
We would love to hear your thoughts based on today's conversation. You can submit your comments to our form at booktalkforbooktalk.com for a chance to have your feedback discussed during a future mini episode.
If you're enjoying the podcast, please visit our website, booktalkforbooktalk.com, to view our latest merch and learn about supporting the show through Patreon, Ko-Fi, or Venmo. You can follow us on TikTok or Instagram at the handle booktalkforbooktalk.
Bye!